Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. The Epistle to the Hebrews tells us that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. That isn't science, it is religion. And these days, many have come to believe that never the twain shall meet. But what if the reality of God could be demonstrated scientifically? What evidence would it take? What would be the consequence? French author Olivier Bonassez has co-authored an internationally best-selling book recently translated into English that grapples with these questions. In God, the Science, the Evidence, Bonassez and his co-author argue that science is in the midst of a great reversal in which the supposedly incompatible realms are becoming mutually reinforcing. Bonassez is a science writer, an entrepreneur, and a graduate of Polytechnique and the Institute of Catholic de Paris. An unbeliever until the age of 20, he is the author of books, videos, scripts, articles, newsletters, and websites on subjects related to faith and reason. He is joined today by Brian Miller, research coordinator for the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Miller obtained a BS in physics with a minor in engineering from MIT and a PhD in complex systems physics from Duke University. His research focuses on thermodynamics, information theory, protein rarity, and the origin of life. This episode of Humanize is sponsored by Palomar Editions, publisher of God, the Science, the Evidence. The questions asked are my own. Olivier and Brian, welcome to Humanize.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with Olivier. You spent years researching and writing this book, which is 500 pages plus long. Why invest so much of your time and energy?
The first reason for the writing of this book is my own story, because when I was 20, I was not a believer at all. And I thought that believers were irrational people. And I discovered, and it was a big surprise for me, that at the end, it's not the case. And the conclusion of our book is that materialists are irrational people today. And the case is very strong. The reason why we wrote this book is not that we are making a special discovery, because all in this book exists in other books. But what we try to do is to make a comprehensive overview of the case in philosophy, morality, history, but above all in science, because science, there is a great reversal in science and it changed everything. We will talk of this. And what we would like to, we make a special effort in order to make it simple for the people, because when people look at this, they can say, oh, it's science. It's very thick. And it's not for me, because I will not understand anything. Not at all, because this book was written specially for people to read it, because it's very, very easy to read and accessible and yet accurate and up to date. So that's the reason of the success of this book, because at the end, for the moment, we sold more than 400,000 copies in Europe. And we hope to do something like this in the U.S. also.
As a fellow author, I'm jealous. Well done. Let's just quickly, what made you shift from being a materialist and a non-believer to a believer?
But Brian will tell us that many scientists in the U.S. did the same. Fred Hoyle, Alan Sandage, and many others. Because, in fact, when you look at the case, if you want to summarize, there is what we call a great reversal, which is which means that for 4 centuries, science seems to be able to explain the world without the hypothesis of God. We can imagine that it will continue like this after Copernic, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, Laplace, Darwin. And at the end of this, Marx and Freud, who claim to be scientists, they said that religion was toxic. It was the opium of the people. So all this create a very strong materialist and scientific intellectual current that dominated in the past. And many people imagine that it will continue like this forever, but not at all, because a series of scientific discoveries, thermodynamics, as you are, Brian, a specialist, thermodynamics, also quantum mechanics, relativity, discovery of the expansion of the universe, discovery of the Big Bang, discovery of complexity in biology, or you are also a specialist, and all the fine tunings of the universe, all this create a very new picture. And because at the end, if you want to summarize the case, you can say that we have four things. First, we live in what we can call a space-time, where time, space, and matter are inextricably linked. Einstein demonstrated this, and it's absolutely clear now for everybody. Second, there is a beginning, an absolute beginning, because it's not only the Big Bang, it's seven different rational approaches conclude that it's impossible that there is an infinite amount of time in the past. And third, there is a fine tuning, not only of the initial data of the universe, but also in the ratio of the different forces of the universe and all the laws of quantum mechanics, physics, chemistry, and biology. All this is absolutely incredibly adjusted and calibrated. So if you have these three things together, you can say that if there is in one moment a beginning to time, space, and matter that emerge together, the cause at the origin of this emergence is by definition outside time, outside space, outside matter. What is the most impressive is that it's outside space, because space began also what you have around you, space, at the beginning, which means that as soon as you have a space, you have time and matter. So the beginning of space is something totally crazy, because if death began, it means that something transcendent creates death. It has the power to create everything that exists, and it also adjusted and calibrated everything so that we can be there.
So let me interrupt you. You're basically saying, and we're going to get into some of these specifics, but you're basically saying that what we now know about things such as the Big Bang theory actually point to a creator as opposed to a materialistic universe. Is that right?
Not really, because perhaps the Big Bang is not the beginning. Perhaps there is other Big Bang before the Big Bang, but there is not an infinite number of Big Bang before the Big Bang.
You would have to go, even if there was a Big Bang before the Big Bang, that doesn't solve the problem for the materialist, because at some point there has to be a beginning.
Yes, exactly. What is sure is that there is not an infinite number of Big Bang and Big Crunch in the past. So there is an absolute beginning in one moment of time, space, and matter. So this is very new, because 150 years ago, nobody knows this in science. But now it's quite sure, because there is many ways to thermodynamics is a very good way to explain that there is a beginning, because if you, Brian will explain this to us. But what I would like to say is that all the global vision points to God. And the most last but not least point, the most important point, is that all the alternatives that try to explain these new discoveries without God have so far failed or are very difficult to sustain. If you imagine, for example, to explain the fine-tuning, the multiverse, the theory of everything, the string theory, all this is dead or quite dead. You have, and the idea that something can, the universe can come from nothing is crazy. So a lot of things like this does not work. And what is very new is that many, many people understand, discover, and arrive to the conclusion that the only possibility is God. Last world, we had talks in Princeton and Berkeley, and we co-produced four documentaries with 10 Nobel Prize winners. And we talked with them, and we said, okay, do you agree with the conclusions of our book? Do you think that if there is a beginning and there is a fine-tuning, the hypothesis of God is an option? And they say, of course, yes. And do you have something else today? No. For the moment, we have nothing to explain this. Okay, so why is it not the best conclusion today? You say, if us as scientists, we say God, we stop working. So we need to try to find something else. But for the moment, we have nothing. And they all They all told us death.
That's very interesting. Brian, real quickly, what got you interested in a career in science?
Well, I was really interested in how the universe worked. And I went into physics because that really deals with the most fundamental principles of reality. And it also, what really inspired me to study science more is very similar to Olivier, is that I became convinced that Christianity was a psychological crutch. I thought that if you're a scientist, you were objective and rational. But if you're a person of faith, you're just sort of more emotional and engage in wishful thinking. But the more I studied science, the more I saw that it really pointed to a creator, which is why I really appreciate the book, because many of the arguments in the book are the very evidence that brought me back to faith.
That's very interesting and strikes me that science first emerged, at least in the West, out of a Christian milieu, didn't it?
No, not at all. And Steve Mayer wrote a book. I have the book here. We translated in French the book of Steve Mayer, The Hypothesis of the Return of the God Hypothesis. And yes. In this book, he explained very well that in fact, modern science began in the Christian world for very specific reasons, because the Christians believe that God is logos, rationality, and God, logos, create a logos, a world with inside the logos, and we are in the logos also. So the rationality is very important for Christians, and also the notion of progress, that we, the Holy Spirit will lead us to the truth. So there is a progress, there is a God who is logos, and all this contribute to create science because God was free and decided to create a world like this. So the Christians said we have to observe, we have to look at what God did with his rationality. And it's very important because in the past, in the antiquity, you have science in Greece, in China, in Persia, in Romans, in everywhere. But the principles of metaphysics of these people were wrong. And because of this, the science cannot develop. For example, the Greek, they said that after the moon, everything is divine in the world. So nothing can change. Everything is perfect. Everything is circular. And they said that the sun and the moon was eternal. And they did not observe and they did not make hypotheses on this because they said God should do something like this. So in fact, the church creates universities, the monks gather all the knowledge, and at the end, all this creates science. And to be sure, to have the proof that science was born, modern science was born in the Christian world, you can look at what Christophe Columbus and Magellan and Vasco da Gama, when they went at the end of the 15th century or the beginning of the 16th century, they went everywhere in the world. And they discovered that Europe has a very huge advance in science and technology compared to everybody because science was raised in the Middle Age in Europe. So that's the reason why Europe dominated the world for 4 centuries after this, because science was born in the Christian world. And
I don't think there's any disputing that. But at some point, didn't the philosophy of science come to hold that science must find, quote, rational or materialistic answers to you know, how the world works? And why did that happen?
Oh, yeah, that's a great story. Again, this debate has been going on since about 500 BC, where you have people like Aristotle and Plato and Socrates who believe that there is a logos, a mind behind the world, while you have people like Democritus and the atomists that believe that everything was simply matter in motion, the laws of nature. And what happened is the pendulum shifted very, very strongly towards the idea of design in the Middle Ages with the rise of the church. But then what you have is people like Isaac Newton, people like Kepler, that recognize that there is these simple laws that define the universe. And of course, they interpret it within the framework of Christianity, because that's the same way God is a God lawgiver for morality. He gives laws for our universe. But what happened in the West is, as you have more skeptical philosophies that emerged, people became more disenchanted with religion for various reasons. And then, of course, with Darwin, where he removed teleology from biology, the pendulum shifted very strongly to a materialistic view of the world, where the idea of a creator was simply removed from conversation, or they would say if there was a God, he was distant and uninvolved. So that shift was very, very dramatic. So again, what's happened that the book really talks about is how the science in the 20th century and the 21st century is causing the pendulum to shift very strongly back towards design.
So let's get some of our terms here. First of all, by materialism, what precisely do we mean?
This book is answering to the only one limited question. Is there a God or not? Which means, is it possible to imagine that there is nothing else than the material universe? Or is it mandatory to say that there is something outside that causes this universe? We are not speaking of religion of faith. We are speaking only of, is there a God or not? A very limited question with only one angle, rationality, and 12 different fields of knowledge in which we are saying that we are making an investigation, and we are saying to the reader that they are the jury of this investigation. They will decide for themselves in each of these 12 independent and different fields of knowledge if it's for them more rational, more clear, more simple to explain this case with God or without God. And we are looking at many cases in science, but also things about philosophy, morality, or enigmas of the history of the humanity. For example, the Bible, the knowledge of the Hebrew compared to the knowledge of every empire around, or the knowledge of the Jewish people, the case of Jesus, or the case of course, miracles like Fatima, something very strange that it's very difficult to explain with our supernatural explanation.
And then what do you mean by God? I take it you're not saying in this book, in fact, I've read the book, you're not saying basically that the Catholic theology has been proved scientifically. You're making a different claim, right?
Yes. We are speaking of a basic definition of God, being outside the universe, transcendent to our universe, that had the power to create everything, and that also adjusted and calibrated everything in order that one day we can be there. It's the very basic definition of God in philosophy or in religion. And it's not specifically Christian. Of course, if the Christian God exists, God exists. It's another way to make the proof that God exists. We are looking, it's not a book about religion or faith. It's a book about, is it possible to be a consistent and coherent materialist today with the scientific knowledge, and not only in science, but the knowledge in every field of knowledge that we have today. And our conclusion is that it's very difficult. For me, what strikes me a lot at the end of this investigation is that it's very simple, very simple. If you want to be an atheist today, it's very difficult because you have to believe in unbelievable things. A lot of unbelievable things. So
what is, if you want to be an atheist, or if you are an atheist, what is one of the unbelievable things you need to accept?
For example, you have to believe that there is no good or evil, for example. Because if there is no God, if there is nothing else than the material universe, we are only a cluster of cells brought there by the laws of physics and chemistry, and crushing a mosquito or a child is just a reorganization of the atoms of the universe. It has absolutely no moral impact. But nobody can live consistently with this vision. Nobody, even the worst atheist, the most convinced atheist, they think, in fact, they live as if there is a good and there is an evil. So it's the chapter number 22 of our book are trying to say to the reader, let's consider that there is no God and there is no good and evil, and look at the consequences. Are you able to be consistent with this? And in fact, it's very difficult.
So Brian, a miracle is something, I guess, that would be defined as an event that has no obvious or clear naturalistic explanation. But if there is a God, aren't miracles also part of the natural world and the natural order?
Yeah, exactly. So if you're an atheist, obviously you won't believe in miracles. Everything has to follow the simple laws of nature that you'll read in a textbook. But if you believe in a creator, then you recognize the laws of nature come from that creator, but then the creator also will use the freedom to act in ways that might be a bit different from those natural laws. So miracles are simply a natural aspect of our world in that God is involved in our world.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense to me. And, you know, I'm not a materialist. And I think you're right about materialism, that it's kind of a paucity of imagination and understanding. because it basically excludes a lot of the human experience. An awful lot of people have had experiences that cannot be explained by just a bunch of carbon molecules interacting. And to refuse to grapple with that, to me, is almost unscientific. You would think that that a true science, which seeks truth and which seeks facts, would want to explore things like that, like Fatima, which you bring up in the book, Olivier. Explain the quote-unquote miracle of Fatima and what science has been able to tell us about it, if anything.
Yes, many people told us it's very curious, a book about science that speaks about Fatima. But the reason is very clear. In the chapter number 3 of our book, you have a list of consequences of the two theses, God exists or God does not exist. But in fact, what the public is not aware of this, but the reason why the question is being framed today in completely new terms, it's because the two theses, God exists and God does not exist, have real-world implications. For example, as we said, if God does not exist, there is an infinite amount of time in the past because the universe should be in one way or another eternal. All can be explained by chance or randomness. You can have good or evil, and you can have also miracles or prophecies or revelations. So if you have one miracle, one real miracle, it's sure that God exists, and the thesis God does not exist is wrong. That's the reason why it's not a matter of faith, it's a matter of knowledge, because all these things can be investigated, can be looked in a knowledge point of view. The key facts for me is that today there is a huge progress of knowledge. There is a lot of things that we know now that 150 years ago, we never know the beginning, we don't know the fine-tuning, we don't know a lot of things. So miracles like Fatima are very simple because it's in a very atheist country, one of the most atheist country in Europe, Portugal. Three little child of 10 years old, at least, they said that they are an apparition for Virgin Mary every 13 of the months, 13 of May, 13 of June, July. And in July, these three child said in 3 months, there will be a miracle because the Virgin Mary wants to be clear for everybody to know this apparition. And a lot of people, dozens of thousands of people came, atheists, believers, everybody, and they saw something incredible at the place, the time, the predict by the people, by the children. How can you explain this?
What did they see?
They saw the sun. The sun was changed the color, turned on itself, and come to the people. It was raining till the morning, and everybody was wet. And at the end, the sun changed everything, and people had the feeling that the sun was coming to them and will crash on the earth, and they were terrified. And it lasted something like 12 minutes. And many people, we said that there is something like 70,000 people in this place. And some people were at 34 kilometers in the east or in the west, and they saw the same thing, and they were not aware of anything.
Wait a second. You're saying that people who were not at the location also saw this phenomenon?
Yes. The most well-known poet of Portugal, he was in his house close to the sea, and he was on the terrace, and he said, he looked at this and he converted. He became a Christian, and he was absolutely not aware of this. And it's a very impressive, many others in 20 kilometers in the east and others saw the same thing. So how can you explain this on a materialist point of view? It's very difficult because you can say that nothing happens, but everyone sees something. You can say that it's something cosmological or meteorological event, very rare. And okay, but how can you explain that three little children said that 3 months before that something like this will happen in a very precise place? As it's impossible. You cannot believe this. So we examine every option, and we say at the end to the reader, you will decide what you want. But for us, it's absolutely clear. For more than 100 years, nobody gave any rational and a natural explanation of death.
And there are photos of people looking at the sun. I've seen those photos. And Brian, if the sun had actually done those things, I think the Earth would have been destroyed, wouldn't it? So is it possible it was just a vision?
Well, the book does a very nice job of going through all the alternative hypotheses. So you don't see people reporting this in other parts of the world. So it's not something that can be explained just by some strange event in the sun that was purely natural. You have many people around that area that saw it. There was no evidence that there was a strange alignment of the stars or the moon or something like that. So the book does a very nice job of going through and trying to say, well, are these natural explanations something that explains all the data? And they don't. So if you look at all the data from the eyewitnesses, what people observed, something happened that can't be explained within a materialist framework. That was the main argument of the book. That's a strong argument.
That's the only point, yes. The only challenge that we try to give to the atheists, say, what is your explanation of this? We don't say that we can explain what God did exactly. Of course, the sun, the other people on the planet, they saw always the sun in the same place. So it's a vision. It's a vision for many, many people. But how can you, is it possible for human people, for these children, to create such an incredible illusion? There is no explanation.
Particularly since it occurred way before there was the kind of technology we have today, no AI, no computers, not a whole lot of, and Portugal was not exactly the richest country either. And so that's all very interesting. You also talk about how scientific advances lead to the conclusion of a creator. And again, we're not talking specifically about the Christian view of the creator, but a creator. And one of them you mentioned was Einstein's theory of relativity. Now, I don't understand Einstein's theory of relativity in the least, but I do know it's important. So just briefly, if you can, for dummies like me, what did Einstein theory, what does it state? And it's proved to be true so far as I understand it. And why does it point toward a creator?
Einstein had an intuition that nobody before him had ever, no scholar, no scientist, no philosopher, that time, space, and matter are inextricably linked, and that the mass of the objects in the universe curve the space. There is a link between mass and space, and time also. Because the speed or the acceleration can change make the time relative. So
the relativity part, it has to do with that time. We experience time in a certain way, but if you're going the speed of light, the experience of time would be different.
Your experience of time will be exactly the same, but if you go at the speed of light, or if you go in a black hole, for example, you will have the same experience of time by yourself. But if you look the universe, you will see the universe accelerating till the end of time before you arrive to the black hole. So it's something absolutely crazy, because if you are close to the sun, for example, the time is running slower. But it looks crazy. But now we are sure of this because all the previsions, the intuitions of Einstein were set in a mathematical model. The mathematical model allowed to make previsions, and all the previsions of Einstein were verified very quickly after he finalized his theory in 1917. And 2 years after, Eddington went in the north of South America to look at an eclipse of the sun, and he saw that the stars behind the sun were seen exactly at the arc of degree, exactly like the theory of Einstein made the prevision. So it was verified very quickly after Einstein's theory, but every day we verified that it's true. So today, everyone agrees. We are in what we call a space-time, where time, space, and matter are linked. And very quickly, two very important scientists, Alexander Friedman and Georges Lemaître, discovered that the equation of Einstein, speaking of the global universe, were unstable, which means that the universe should be contracting or expanding. It cannot be stable. It's not possible. It's like a pen that you like this. It can not be stable because every perturbation will make it go in one way or another. They said that the universe was expanding, and the experimentation and the observation of Hubble confirmed this. And at the end, Georges Lemaître was very clear and very, he always was very right in his physical intuitions. And he said, what is crazy? It's not the beginning of time and matter. It's the beginning of space, because we are pointing a moment where space began. And the beginning of space is something crazy, because you cannot imagine anything without space. So if there is a beginning of space, and as we said, as soon as space began, you have the beginning of time and matter, because in the real world, in this world, you have quantum fields, and you have a lot of things. As soon as you have space, you have time and matter. So
how does that point to a creator, though?
Of course, what is for me very surprising is, at the end, it's so simple. A child can understand this.
But I can't.
A child. Of course, if you say to the people the right conclusion, you say, I spoke with Nobel Prize winner, with the guy of the James Webb, the senior scientist of the James Webb telescope, the girl of the senior scientist of the Hubble telescope, and I ask her, can we agree that there is an absolute beginning of space? And we discussed a lot, and at the end she said yes. And if there, just imagine that there is a beginning of space, you need a cause. Of course, you need a cause. And the cause is outside space, something different. It's a spirit. So when I say
one of the great physicists of our time, Stephen Hawking, disagreed with you. So what was Stephen Hawking's position on this?
That's a very good case, because, you know, Stephen Hawking in his last book, he said, because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself without God from nothing. And in this sentence, you have two logical problems. The first one is that if you have a law such as gravity, it's not nothing, it's something.
Yes, so it's, that's true.
The universe will create itself from nothing. It's not from nothing, because you have a law such as gravity. It's not nothing, it's something. The first problem. Second problem, the universe will create itself. It's not possible to create oneself. You cannot be before you in order to create you. It's not possible. It's absolutely crazy. So that's why our friend John Lennox in Oxford said, nonsense remains nonsense, even when talked by the world famous scientists. So, you know,
Brian,
it's very...
let me get Brian in here real quick. Do you agree with what Olivier just said with regard to Stephen Hawking?
Yes. In fact, I went through in great detail the research papers that Hawking and his collaborator Hartle published. So it's basically this idea of quantum cosmology. He developed what's called a universal wave function. And when you actually look through the mathematics in the paper doesn't define nothing as actually nothing. When they say nothing, they really mean a universe that already exists.
Well,
so Hawking, yes, it is. Yes, it is. So what they've shown is how a small universe could become a larger universe, but they do not show how a universe could come from nothing. A Lawrence Krauss makes the same mistake. So that's just equivocation. They're using language in a way that's very, very misleading.
And Olivia,
exactly. And you know, some people say that the universe began from quantum fluctuation. It's exactly the same, because in order to have a quantum fluctuation, you need to have space already. So it's not the beginning of space. So it's a, you know, it's very surprising that so people so smart and so intelligent like Stephen Hawking, they are led to say crazy things because of the problem they have. They want to stay atheist and they say crazy things because they cannot do otherwise.
So some people might accuse you of putting the thumb on the scale because you're a believer. And so you're going to tend to look at the evidence and basically come to the conclusion that you already held. But they never say the same thing about people like Stephen Hawking. And so I guess that raises the question, did you allow your faith, which is real, to influence your conclusions in the book?
As I told you, I was not a believer at all at the beginning. And I did not want to tell me stories in order to be well and to say, oh, it's very hard to believe a world without God, so I will believe in God. No, at all. I don't want to tell me a false story. So, and I can tell you that when I was not a believer and I discovered the evidence, immediately I had a problem and I cannot answer to this kind of problems. But I did not change my mind in 5 minutes. It took me 2 years. Because when you are in a certain vision of the world, it's very hard to change. So for me, I made this experience that I had immediately a problem when I looked at this evidence in a atheist point of view, but it took me a lot of time to admit, to accept that the implications of these evidence.
So if you're saying basically if one is intellectually honest with oneself, which isn't always easy, you became a believer because of where the evidence took you. You didn't decide that the evidence pointed to a creator because you were a believer.
Absolutely.
And Brian, what about you?
Well, I'm very similar in that I became pretty convinced that God didn't exist. And then I went on this quest of looking at the evidence. And there's a famous quote, and I can't remember who it's attributed to, but the quote is that a little science will often take people away from God, but a lot of science will bring them right back. Because for me, I was leaning against the reality that God existed, but I found the science overwhelming that God did exist, that there was a creator to our universe.
And I think perhaps for some people, the problem with that is if there's a creator to the universe, that means we have to deal with it as human beings and that we may not actually be in total control. And we might have to, in a humbling way, submit ourselves to something greater than ourselves. Do you think that's part of the issue?
Yes, we are saying this in the introduction of our book. We say that we try to make this case a rational case, to be very factual. But at the end, this question is a passionate question, a very emotional question. And the reason why people do not accept, we have also Nobel Prize winners like George Wald, who say, okay, all the evidence point to God, but I will not accept God for philosophic reasons. It's crazy, but people react like this, a lot of them.
But that pushes them out of the science realm
and
into philosophy. So you can't say, they cannot say, well, let me ask it in a more direct way. Can and does anyone say that the science proves there is no God?
No, not at all. We have another one, Richard Levantine, who said we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. He said that as a scientist, he need to make the proof that materialism is correct. But where is it written? Yeah. It's in his mind only.
But, if the point of science is to learn what the truth is, you're coming in there with a predetermined view, at least as to perhaps the most important foundation for everything.
You know, in our book, there is a very original chapter that shows that how the scientists who discovered the Big Bang were violently persecuted by atheist regime in Russia, in Germany, and even in China.
Why was this?
The reason was that all these people, I can show you the list, they were not making politics and they were only making science. But all these people were persecuted, tortured, fired, and led to the gulag because they were disciples of Friedman and they said there is a beginning. And for the Russian communist regime, it was impossible because if there is a beginning, there is a God.
So the Big Bang points toward a God, a creator, because to have the Big Bang, there has to be a beginning. Is that right?
It's so simple.
Brian, why having a beginning, why does that require a God?
Well, there's principles in reality, just the bedrock of reality, like the principle of sufficient reason, the cause and effect relationships, that if something happens, it needs to have a cause. The only exception would be something that was eternal. That would be like God. But anything that begins, something had to begin it. So what happens is if the universe started where time, space, matter, and energy all began, then the cause of the universe had to be outside of time. That the cause had to be outside of space. And that cause had to be unimaginably powerful to start the universe. In addition, as the book talks about, because the laws of nature were designed with the purpose of supporting life, that cause had to be personal because that cause made a decision to create an outcome for a purpose.
Kind of hard to get away from that.
We can answer also with Parmenides, one of the first atheists in Greece. Parmenides said ex nihilo nihil, which means from nothing, nothing can come. And it's a principle on which everybody agrees, in fact, from nothing, nothing can come. So if, except Lawrence Krauss or people like that, but so Parmenides said, okay, there is something around me. So there was no time where there was nothing. Something has always existed. And he said, I'm an atheist, so I think that the universe has always existed. But there is another possibility that there a God outside the universe that always existed and create a universe that began. And for centuries, science cannot say anything about this. But in one moment, thermodynamics was discovered in the 19th century. And thermodynamics said that everything in the universe wears out. Everything, stars will burn out and cease to exist. And Carnot, Kepler, and Kelvin were the first working on thermodynamics. They said, how is it possible that the stars are still burning? Because at the end, we are going towards the thermal death of the universe. The thermal death is a moment when all the stars will cease to exist and cease to give us light and energy. So as soon as we are not in this thermal death state, it means that there is a beginning. Because if we were there for an infinite amount of time, the stars should have ceased to exist for an infinite amount of time also. So the proof of the beginning came first in science from thermodynamics. What do you think, Brian?
No, that's a really powerful argument, because just for those who are listening who may not be as comfortable with the idea of thermodynamics, is that's a science that deals with things like work and heat and energy. And one of the most foundational principles in our universe, the bedrock of reality, is that nature will tend to go to a state of what's called free energy. And free energy is just useful energy. It's like energy in a battery. The energy in a battery can be used to run an electric car, or it can be used to run a toy. But what happens is when energy just gets dispersed, like heat in the environment, can't be used to do useful work. Only gradients of heat can do that. So what happens is the universe is always going to a state of lower and lower free energy, or you might talk about it in terms of higher and higher entropy or disorder, crudely speaking. So what happens is if the universe is like a clock which is winding down, then the universe can't be eternal, because if the universe started eternally in the past, all we would have is basically protons and electrons and particles. There would be no stars. There would be no galaxies. There would be nothing of significance that would exist. So that means if you go rewind the clock, there had to be a specific beginning where everything was set up properly.
And what is the anthropic principle, and why does that point to a God, Olivier?
The anthropic principle is a formula, but in fact, I prefer to speak of fine tunings of the universe, because you have something like 20 or 30 parameters that are very, very fine-tuned in order that we can be there. And it's very curious, because the figures are gigantic. And if you imagine that you create a lottery among all the inhabitants of Earth, 8 billion people, chance exists. So you will have the first lottery and somebody will win. And you can interview him and say, okay, what do you think? Say, I had a lot of chance. Okay. But you organize the same lottery the next week, and the same guy is winning. We say, wow, a third time you are doing the lottery, and the same is also, and you go to interview him, and you say, what do you think? I had a lot of chance. But the police will come and say, no, it's not possible. You are cheating, because we need another explanation. And you are winning to the lottery every day for a long time. You need another explanation. If you play dice and you get a double six, every time, 10 times, 100 times in a row, you need another explanation. It's a specific order, and it's not possible to explain that by chance. You have to find something else. And it's exactly what the conclusion that we had looking at the universe. If you look at the first expansion rate of the universe, if you look at the distribution of mass and energy in this universe, if you look at the anisotropies of the CMBR, if you look at many, many things, if you look at the mass of the proton and the mass of the electron, if you look at the many, many things, it's very, very fine-tuned. So, and if it was a little different, we will not be there to talk about this. So it's very impressive to look precisely, and we are trying to do this in the book. We are trying to make it simple in order that the people can understand. You know, Fred Hoyle is very well described in this book of Stephen Mayer. Fred Hoyle was an atheist, and he fought against Georges Lemaître because of his conviction that it's not possible that there is a beginning because there is a God. So he was the one who coined the term Big Bang in order to mock the concept. But at the end, he became a believer because he discovered that the production of carbon in the earth of stars needs a very special level of excited carbon. And he said, in this time, this excited carbon was not known by anybody. And he understood that we could not have carbon in our universe or oxygen or things like this if this very specific value of carbon exists. And in one day, he discovered with Caltech, he pushed the president of Caltech to discover this value. And when it was discovered, he said, okay, now I'm sure that there is a super intellect behind the universe, because this value depends on a lot of things. If you change of 1% the mass of the quark up or quark down, you can't not have carbon in the universe. So this guy, Fred Hoyle, finished his life as a deist because he said there is a super intellect behind this.
So Brian, talk a little bit more about this idea of fine-tuning. That's part of what the intelligent design theory has to do with as well, isn't it?
That's correct. So in our community, we look at design in every aspect of nature, the way the laws of nature are designed in life and the design of our planet. But when you go to the laws of nature, what happens? If you imagined that you had a device that created universes, and this device had lots of knobs and dials, so you could control the force of gravity. You turn the dial up, you feel heavier. You turn the dial down, you feel lighter. Another dial controlled the mass of a quark. Another dial controlled the strength of the force of electrons and protons attracting each other. What would happen is if you randomly set all these dials, you hit your button and you create a universe, it's virtually impossible for that universe to support life. It would either be a bunch of black holes, a diffuse soup of simple particles. You wouldn't have chemistry. You wouldn't have planets. But to get a planet support, a universe that supports life, you've got to set those dials very, very carefully. Some, you could imagine the dial would be like between 1 and 100. You might have to set it between like 86 and 89. Other dials, it's much more extreme. Like gravity, for instance, if you assume gravity could be anywhere from zero to the strong nuclear force, you'd have to set that dial with unimaginable precision. It'd be like trying to shoot a target that's 1 centimeter in diameter at the other end of our solar system. That's the precision necessary to set the specific values of the laws of the constants of nature to have a universe that supports life. And that points to the idea that there is a mind that designed our universe with that purpose.
Does the vastness of the universe, which just is beyond human comprehension, have any impact on this thinking?
Well, what happens is we have one universe with one set of laws as far as we know. So it doesn't matter how big the universe is. The point is the laws have to be right. But what does matter is if you set up a universe, what's important is not simply those dials, those how strong gravity is, but you have to set up the initial conditions. So in many ways, even the size of our universe, the fact that we have all these galaxies, is necessary for life, because you have to set everything up just right to allow the universe to expand, to allow for planets to develop, to allow for stars to come into existence. So even the size of our universe appears to be designed with life in mind, and also, I would believe, just to express God's glory and his grandeur.
Interesting. You know, I was thinking as you were talking a bit about Buddhism. I'm not a Buddhist, but I've studied it a bit. And Buddhists would say this is all an illusion, that the material world is an illusion and doesn't really exist. But even Buddhists, which is not a theistic philosophy, but even Buddhists says there's a state of being that we are all one with if we get to the ultimate goal of life is to be one with all that is. But all that is not nothing.
We are a little speaking of Buddha in this book, because concerning the beginning, Buddha said that we cannot make any decision because we cannot know anything. But it's not the case. Today, we can know things. What is very surprising is all what Brian described. It's the fine tunings of the universe is something that we know for only something like 60 or 70 years. Before, nobody knows that all the settings of the universe were so precise. In 1936, he was in Princeton. We were in the room where he taught. He said he received a letter from a little girl whose name is Phyllis I don't know the name. She said, do scientists pray? Einstein answered 10 days after with a letter in German, and he said, everyone who is seriously involved in the pursuit of science become convinced that some spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe, one that is vastly superior to that of man. This was a very powerful idea, and an idea that Einstein was the first to express in Princeton a few decades before the discoveries of the many fine tunings of the universe. So it's a, he had the, this feeling that an intelligence, a very incredible intelligence, is beyond the universe. And all these discoveries, dozens of discoveries, make the proof of this. There is an incredible intelligence behind this.
One of the things you included in the book, Beyond Science, you included some issues beyond science. And I'm not sure, I'll be frank with you, that that was a wise decision, because I think the science aspect of it is the key part. But you claim that the history of the Jewish people points to a creator. How is that?
For example, for many reasons, but we are examining 10 things that the Jewish people claimed in the past. They say, for example, that the sun and the moon were not divinity. All the empires around them, the Egyptians, the Persians, the Romans, the Greeks, every we have a page in which we are saying that the name and all people in the antiquity, they said that the moon and the sun were divinity, and they gave a name to these divinities. And the Jewish people said, no, the sun and the moon are not divinities. They are there to give us light, and they had the beginning, they will have an end, and they were created by God. And all the people said they are crazy, because they have absolutely no library, no intellectual life, no books, no nothing. And they were only shepherds. They were a little small group. And they said to everybody, you're wrong, because God told us that there is a beginning to the sun. And so at the end, for centuries, nobody can make the proof that they were right. But now we are sure, we are absolutely sure that the sun had the beginning and it will have an end.
Basically saying that there, long before science emerged, that their understanding of certain realities demonstrates, that kind of revelation demonstrates that there was information coming from beyond their own thinking.
You have two options. Either they had a lot of chance from 10 different points. They have a lot of chance and they were sure to be right, but by chance. It's a possibility. Another possibility is that, as they said, that somebody, God, reveal these kind of things. So you have the choice. You can say, I believe God is the better explanation. Or you can say, no, I believe that the best explanation is to say that they have a lot of chance. These people, these Jewish people, 3,000 years ago, they said, we are a very special people. We are elected people. We are an eternal people. And today, all the people from antiquity disappeared because they have not the same language, they have not the same religion, and they have not the same country. You have only one people remains from antiquity, is the Jewish people, and they had not the most simple history. It's something that defies every laws of sociology or history. So you can say, okay, it's by chance, it's a possibility, or you can say, no, it's because they have a link with God or something, and it's a better explanation than saying sin.
Particularly given the incredible evil and attempts to eradicate a Jewish people in the last 3,000 years, and it hasn't been able to be done. So that's a issue for another program, but I get your point. We're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, how has this book been received by the scientific community?
In fact, there is, of course, in the scientific community, there is, in Europe, a majority of atheist or agnostic people. First, many people reviewed the book with us, because when we were writing this book, with Michel Yves, we were writing chapters. One of us wrote the first, and the other wrote upon him and like this. And when we were okay with our text, we send this to specialists like Robert Wilson, for example, the Nobel Prize, who review our cosmology, and he said, oh, great, I like it. And he made the preface of our book. So we made a review from many people. And at the end, it was rewrite by people in order to be very simple. So all this work, I don't remember why that was taken. What was your question? Excuse me.
What was the reaction of the scientific community?
The reaction of the scientific community. So many scientists that we contact for them were agnostic or atheist. And some of them changed. I can tell you that one of the top scientists in France in the CNRS, because of our book, he said now he's not an atheist, he is an agnostic. And he said, but please tell it to nobody because it will make me problems. No, we had a lot of contacts like that. And the one day, you know, I have there is a very interesting chapter with 100 scientists, the citations of 100 scientists. And the number two of these citations is from Roger Penrose. Roger Penrose is a very well-known scientist. And he wrote something incredible. He wrote something I will tell you. In order to start off the universe in a state of low entropy so that there is a second law of thermodynamics, the creator M must have been, namely, to an accuracy of 1 part in 10 to the power of 10 to the power of 123. This is an extraordinary figure. So this guy is to summarize, he said that the distribution of mass and energy at the beginning of the universe is set with a precision, with an incredible precision. And he said the creator has to point and with a very, very incredible accuracy. And he wrote the name, the creator, and he said he's not a believer. So I said to John Lennox, how is it possible that somebody writes something like this and say he's not a believer? John Lennox told me, you cannot imagine the pressure of the academic scientists in the UK, and not only in UK, everywhere. So
the Center for Science and Culture, Brian, has seen this kind of pressure that is brought to bear to try to discredit anyone that steps outside of the naturalistic approach, right?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of stories of people like Rick Sternberg, people like Guillermo Gonzalez, that when scientists publicly state that they see evidence of design, or they question the status quo, basically the secular creation narratives, they can face enormous challenges. They can have their jobs removed. They can be blacklisted. So it can be very problematic.
And that is not open academic inquiry. That is suppression of theories that one doesn't support, which is an anti-science approach. Science is supposed to accept heterodox theories and test them.
Of course, but you know, In every part of the world, you have a dominant mentality. You have something that dominates. And today, what dominates science because of the great reversal, for centuries, science seems to be the best way to say God does not exist. So because we have an inertia, we have a problem of time. You know, Planck, Max Planck, one of the most important discoverers of quantum mechanics, he said, a new theory will never succeed. It's only when his opponents will die, eventually die.
When what will eventually die?
The opponents.
The opponents.
Yes, because in fact, it's very difficult to change your mind. And when there is a dominant mentality like this, it takes a lot of time. That's the situation.
And Galileo saw that with regard to...
Yes, of course.
And, you know, he's used as the reason why religion shouldn't be part of science, but it's actually all of it emerged as we talked about earlier from a religious context. Let me just summarize your argument. You tell me if I'm accurate. You claim that the book, because it's really quite a remarkable book, is God, the Science, the Evidence, The Dawn of a Revolution by Michel-Yves Bolloré and Olivier Bonassé. And they were writing in France. French, which is a much more secular society than the United States. And yet they not only emerged out of the French version, but they're now all around the world with this book. It's quite a remarkable achievement. But let's summarize your argument. The claim is that the preponderance of the evidence points towards a creator, but it's not absolute proof, right?
Yes, you don't have absolute proof in the real world. We have absolute proof only in mathematics or limited universes. If you say in mathematics or if you play chess, you can say a mate in 2 or 3 moves. In limited universes, you have absolute proof. But in the real world, you need to be like Sherlock Holmes. You have to look at evidence and converging evidence. And what is very remarkable today is that the convergence of evidence in every field of knowledge. As we said, in science, in many different fields of knowledge in science, but also in philosophy, morality, story, enigmas, and many things. So And the key point, the reason why we are speaking of science in this book, especially we have a special focus on science, it's because science seems to be the way to explain the world without God. And now this is totally changed. There is an incredible shift, major shift over the last 5 centuries. We never saw a shift like this in science before. And today it's clear.
And then you also claim that the science is actually supported by philosophy and faith, but it isn't necessary because the evidence that you present basically creates a case for the existence of a creator God without getting into the exact nature of that creator.
Yes, we are not speaking of who is God, what does he want, what does he say. No, it's not in the book. It's another investigation. When you say there is a God, from science or philosophy, you cannot say a lot of things. It's like when you see footsteps in the sand, you can say that there is a cause, sure, but you cannot say who is the guy who make this. So
yeah.
If you want to say more about God, you need another investigation because you need a revelation, and you need to see among all the people who propose revelations, where is the credible revelation? So that's why I have another project with 1,000 reasons to believe in Jesus. And we have a lot of publications like this with prophecies, apparitions, and this is another investigation, but it's not in this book. In this book, we have only the investigation about the existence of God, and we need another one if you want to know
and
who is
God. If you
want
to get into God's nature, then that may be the next project. Well, we're out of time, and I just want to thank you both for being on Humanize. Olivier just said what's next for him. It sounds like continuing to explore these questions and try to find out the nature of the creator. And
yes.
Brian, what's in it? What's next for you?
Well, what's happened is you have people like Bill Dembski, people like Stephen Meyer, Mike Behe, that have made a very, very strong case that you see design throughout nature. One of the projects I'm involved with now is how do we take that knowledge and do better science? So how do we create manuals for future biologists that would help them to make better predictions, to help them understand what they see at a deeper level? So now we're basically putting the rubber to the road and saying, now that we have the case for a designer, let's improve science, let's improve technology, let's improve and serve culture by that knowledge.
Because you're not excluding a part of reality as the materialistic approach does, right?
Yeah, and what you find, absolutely, and what you find is that materialistic approach has slowed the progress of science. It's misdirected people. So when you break away from that false assumption, that frees scientists to be much more productive in their fields.
And open to whatever the truth is, not just 3/4 of what the truth might be.
Exactly.
Well, thank you both very much for being on Humanize, and congratulations, Olivier, on a very successful project. And please give my regards to your co-author.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, everyone.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.